The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Welcome to Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice. I'm Melanie Hildreth, and I'm here with IJ attorneys Anya Bidwell and Patrick Giacomo to talk about a case that they filed on behalf of a 72-year-old woman who was thrown in jail for criticizing her local government. Anya, Patrick, I'd like to start by talking about Sylvia and who she is. The story is outrageous. It gets more outrageous, and there's a lot to unpack. So let's just dive right in.
Sure. So by now, after all this has happened, Sylvia is now 75 years old, and she's a wonderful woman, a retiree who lives in a very small town called Castle Hills, Texas, which is in the larger San Antonio metro area. So Castle Hills has about 5,000 residents, whereas San Antonio has about 2 million. And Sylvia, after a fulfilling career in communications, retired and had a lot of time on her hands. And so she decided that in her retirement, she would focus on community service. And to do that, she ran for city council of her small town, Castle Hills, where she's lived for about 20 years.
And what did she find? One of the things that's interesting is she's 72 at the time, knocking on doors. She talked to about 500 people, got a lot of information. What kinds of things did she find out?
Yeah, so Sylvia actually had a very surprising experience because, as you said, she talked with hundreds of people in her campaign, and she discovered that there was an enormous amount of dissatisfaction with the way the city of Castle Hills was being managed. People were very frustrated because they had raised concerns with the city and had received no response, or they had no ability to contact or interface with the city. And so they expressed those concerns with Sylvia while she was campaigning.
And what is that? What can she do about that once she's elected?
So actually, one of the people that Sylvia spoke with suggested to her that she should organize a petition drive to voice some concern with the way the city was being managed. And she thought that was a great idea. And so after Sylvia was elected to city council, she championed a non-binding citizen signed petition drive that would be submitted to the city management and the city's commission that actually suggested that they should change the city manager and focus on municipal services like fixing the streets.
And that seems not outrageous. What happened, though, to her after the petition was submitted?
Well, essentially, there was a campaign of harassment to force her out of office, right? And we don't have to guess this. One of the council members actually wrote about it in a newsletter. To remove a council member, he said, get a conviction or file a civil suit to remove this council member for incompetence. And that essentially what we see happening, mirroring this newsletter from a council member. They basically first began investigating Sylvia after she presented, after she championed that petition. They began investigating her for allegedly trying to steal that very petition that she championed. And that's because they have this video of her putting one set of papers into her folder, right? And somehow that means that she was trying to steal something that she actually had an interest in not being stolen. As they were investigating her, they also tried to remove her from office, right? They basically said, oh, you were improperly sworn in by somebody. And it is ironic because the mayor, one of the defendants in the case, was also, if she wasn't properly sworn in, then he was also improperly sworn in because they had the exact same quote unquote defect, right? So Sylvia said, no, I was totally properly sworn in. What you're doing is not right. So they saw that she was fighting that, right? So because she was fighting that and not willing to give up her seat, she actually ended up in jail after that months-long investigation, right? And that's where the crux of the matter really are, because we're talking about sort of a retaliatory motive, right? And here it was to intimidate her from ever speaking out again. And they, in arresting her, they wanted to make sure that she would end up in jail, right? As a council member, usually if you are to be brought before a judge, you get summons issued, right? And then you don't really have to go to jail. There are also other procedures in Bexar County. When you go through a DA, you can process through a courtroom rather than going through a jail. But they used a specific technicality generally reserved for violent criminals to ensure that this 72-year-old lady would actually have no other option but be taken to jail, wear an orange shirt, have her mugshot taken, sit on a cold metal bench, use a bathroom with no doors, right? They wanted to make sure she would go through that experience. So then after that, she would stop fighting. But guess what? When she got out of jail at the end of that day, she continued to fight. She said, no, I'm not going to, I'll continue to talk. I'll continue to be council member. And that's when they engineered a lawsuit, just like that council member originally talked about, to remove her for incompetence. And the irony there is that they actually used those criminal charges that they filed against her now to say that she was incompetent and tried to remove her civilly. And in the end of it, none of that was really legally proper, right? The district attorney basically said, dismiss all charges against her. The district attorney also said, I don't want to pursue this civil lawsuit, right? And a judge in Bexar County said, granted a temporary restraining order in her favor, saying that she can keep her seat. But in the end of the day, those three things, even though they didn't work on the books, they work in a way that they finally intimidated her, and she gave up her counsel seat. She could no longer pay her attorney's fees. So it was kind of like a death by thousand cuts in a way, and this harassment campaign ended up in Sylvia giving up her fight for her counsel seat and giving up that kind of fighting to remove the city manager.
I want to go back to the being thrown in jail piece, because that seems like it escalated so quickly, you know, from the allegation like, oh, you weren't properly sworn in, or we're going to investigate you. And I wrote a newsletter about how, you know, how we can go about this. That all seems kind of like petty bureaucratic stuff. And what was she actually arrested for? How do you get from that kind of petty bureaucratic backstabbing behavior to jail?
Yeah, that's a great question. It really, and kind of again, gets to the crux of the matter, because she was arrested for tampering with government record, right? And Patrick and I, we filed a Freedom of Information Act request, right? To see how many people in Sylvia's situation, right, are actually being arrested for this tampering with government thing, right? And apparently nobody, right? All the people who are being charged with this tampering statute, they are either falsifying driver's licenses or falsifying social security numbers or immigration papers or something like that. There isn't anything where you're actually trying to present a petition, a non-binding petition that doesn't even have a legal force, to the city council and being arrested for that. So essentially this statute is being used as a pretext to make sure she ends up in jail. And why she ended up in jail? Because they tried twice before to get her to quit, right? First by just investigating her. And, you know, if you're investigated, they harass you with letters and emails, and they ask questions about you, right? So that's already stressful. She didn't cave. Then they actually tried to get her to quit because she was supposedly improperly sworn in. She fought that, right? And when they saw that that was not going to be easy, they felt like, okay, maybe this will teach her a lesson. If she ends up on that metal jail wearing an orange shirt, maybe then she'll quit. So that's essentially, that's the escalation, but the statute was a total pretext.
So it's tampering with government documents, and they're saying, okay, so you present this petition, you're cleaning up after the council meeting, and this was your opportunity to steal it, you stole it, and that therefore is tampering with a government record?
Right, and they basically say, at first, looks like when they were investigating her, maybe they were trying to get her to basically, like, she was trying to maybe fake signatures or something like that, but they really didn't have anything there, right? So they ended up with this absurd charge of stealing, which really has, you know, nothing to do with any similar type of a factual situation where people are being charged under the statute.
Yeah, and like Anya said, almost all of the charges you see under the statute, either as a felony or a misdemeanor, involve something like a fake ID. And I think something in this case that makes it seem as egregious as it really is that Initially, this was assigned to a normal police officer who worked for the Castle Hills Police Department, and he investigated and found no crime. And then they pulled in this special detective who has some relationship to either the mayor or the police chief, who then spent 2 months coming up with this very interesting and novel application of this statute to find a way to arrest Sylvia for what she did here, which was express herself and the concerns of her constituents.
So why, I mean, that seems like the job of the local politician who has gone and knocked on doors and heard the complaints of the constituents. Why this reaction? Why were people so vehemently, people on the city council, the mayor, so vehement about getting rid of her?
Yeah, I mean, she said something that was a threat to their power, right? She said, and she championed this idea that the city manager is not doing a good enough job and should be replaced with another person. And that city manager is very friendly with the mayor, with the police chief, with those guys, right? And the idea that this guy would be replaced with somebody who is very likely to not be as friendly with them is a threat to their power, right? So that was really the motivation. And what's so horrible about this is, you know, the First Amendment, that's what it really protects at the end of the day, the ability of, you know, citizens to speak out if they're unhappy with people who are running things, right? And that's fundamentally what the petition was about, saying, we're not happy, and it wasn't a binding petition or anything. It's just an expression of political thought, saying we are fundamentally unhappy with the way this guy is doing things. But that very American thing is actually what ended up getting her in jail, because city manager was friendly with those folks, and they wanted to make sure that he stays on.
So I want to talk about the First Amendment lawsuit, but Patrick, before we talk about the lawsuit itself, It seems kind of crazy that it would even get to the point where she would need to file a lawsuit. I mean, isn't there some sort of check or balance within it? I mean, this sounds like this crazy gathering of all of the local honchos to team up against this woman. Isn't there some other check built in within local government itself that could have kind of helped her out before IJ had to get involved?
Yeah, no, you're right to observe that. And I think the main problem here is highlighted by Anya's response to why were they so concerned is that all the power in this small town was controlled by a small group of people. And so this was viewed as a giant threat to their control of the city and all of its resources. And along the same lines, the other side of that coin is that because the city was captured by this group of people, they could cover all their bases and make sure that there weren't any checks. And so in this case, as Anya outlined, you have actions being taken by the city attorney to attempt to get Sylvia off city council on a technicality based on her swearing in. But you also have the police department in conjunction with the mayor and the city manager working it from the other side. And so once you have sort of the power of the city behind you on either one of those fronts, the deck is stacked in your favor. And so unless someone is really willing to do what it takes to fight back in courts, which Sylvia did admirably in this case. And you know, one of the things that's been so devastating was she basically had to fight a battle on three fronts because she was defending the civil action against her. She was defending the criminal charges against her. And then she was also fighting in court to keep her seat, to get that TRO that Anya mentioned earlier. And so the answer is there should be checks, and one of the checks should be supplied by the U.S. Constitution, among other things. But when the city is controlled by a single group of people, there aren't any practical checks. And the only checks that are available, like a lawsuit under the Constitution, has to face all this special burdens of immunity doctrines and things like that.
Do you know if this is a scenario like what is playing out in Capitol Hill or in Castle Hills in terms of that collection of power among a small group like that gives them this kind of impunity to go after people? Is that pretty typical of small governments? Like that are there, this is something unique to Sylvia's town, or is this something that plausibly could happen just about anywhere?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a small town, probably about the size of Castle Hills, in a very different setting. And anecdotally, based on that experience and working in around the Midwest and other small towns, this is fairly characteristic of a small town government, because it's always run by usually a small group of people that kind of does whatever it once and faces very little resistance, in part because when resistance is put up, they have the power of the city or the municipality or the county to throw its weight around in their favor. And the people that they're dealing with on the other side don't have that power. And to do anything against this municipal or county government is often very difficult, very expensive, and very time consuming.
So in Sylvia's case, it did go to go back to court, go to another lawsuit. Anya, could you talk about IJ's case? What are the claims that we brought when we filed? We came in, told Sylvia we wanted to help her out. What did we, how did that go? What did we do?
Yes, so we filed a complaint with two counts in them, right? The first count is a retaliation against her political speech. Against individuals, specific individuals, like the mayor, the special investigator, the police chief, right? That was the first count. And the second count was retaliation by the city itself, right? That it was essentially that these individuals constitute the city. So you have count one against individuals, count two against the municipality itself, and her. The heart of her case is First Amendment retaliation. She spoke out against those in power and she ended up in jail for it and ended up having to go through this campaign of harassment. That's kind of our main heart of the lawsuit. But then, of course, we also have to fight all these additional threshold doctrines like qualified immunity that make it very difficult for Sylvia to open the courthouse door in the first place, right? After we basically said that she was retaliated against, and the crux there is we have to show that but for this retaliatory animus, right, she would have, that they would have not taken this action against her. And we provide in the complaint plenty of evidence that really, if they really were concerned with this harassment, with this tampering with government records statute, right, that there were so many other ways to ensure that she would answer for that other than having her end up in jail, right? That if they really thought that she was improperly sworn in, then they surely would have been worried about the mayor being improperly sworn in as well, right? So we allege in our complaint all these additional facts that show that it really was the retaliatory, that's a term of art, the lawyers use it, right? Retaliatory animus. Had it not been for that negative feeling towards her speech, they would have not done that. So we put it out there and we provide plenty of evidence, including stuff that we got from the Freedom of Information Act requests, right? So this is more than, generally speaking, complaints provide. And yet, not surprisingly, we get a motion to dismiss right away, basically saying that, oh, no matter what you guys are saying, you can't sue us just given the kind of position in the government that we hold. I don't know how deeply you want to get into this right now or you want to ask us more questions later on that. So I'll stop.
Well, I did tease sort of in the intro that the case gets even more outrageous later. And I do want to talk about the qualified immunity because that's, very timely in terms of the national conversation. But before we get there, I think that people probably aren't everybody thinks that they know sort of First Amendment lawsuits because those are among the things that show up on TV and in the news. I mean, that's something that most of us non-lawyers can follow. But this idea of retaliation, I think, is interesting and maybe not as well understood. And so, Patrick, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the lay of the land when it comes to retaliation and the just what does the law look like there? And what is the situation that IJ is in as we come in on Sylvia's behalf in this circumstance?
Right. So most people intuitively understand the First Amendment's provision of the right to speak and the right to petition, which is just you can kind of say whatever you want and the government can't get in the way. And part and parcel of that is that you can't say whatever you want and then face some sort of repercussions for it later. It's not just a matter of prior restraint. So the government can violate your First Amendment rights by stopping you from speaking somehow, but it can also violate your rights by punishing you for speaking. And that's what we're talking about in Sylvia's case. And the thing that really complicates facts in this situation and one of the main issues that we're litigating here is that When one of the ways you're retaliated against is that you're arrested for a crime, the Supreme Court has said if there's probable cause to believe you committed a crime, that you essentially can't raise a First Amendment claim outside of a very small circumstance. And we're saying this is that circumstance. So the Supreme Court's explained that even when there is probable cause to believe you've committed a crime, if there's evidence that that is a pretext, like Anya mentioned earlier, then you can still bring a First Amendment claim. And so the textbook example, the one the court cited was, it can't be that even though you did in fact jaywalk, that a police officer can arrest you for jaywalking just because you talked back to him, when other people similarly situated to you wouldn't have been arrested for jaywalking. And so in this case, we're saying that's exactly what happened here, except instead of talking back to a police officer, Sylvia was speaking out against city management. And instead of getting arrested for jaywalking, she was arrested under this odd tampering statute. And our point here is no one else has been arrested like Sylvia or charged under this statute because, as Anya mentioned earlier, it's basically reserved for prosecuting people who have or make fake IDs or similar government documents.
And Anya mentioned that you did a Freedom of Information Act, and was that just specific to the county? Like you say, okay, well, within this county, similar cases, this is the only time they ever used it. Or do you have to, how specific to the jurisdiction does that information have to be?
Right. So our information is specific to the county. And that's actually a question that the court never answered in its earlier decision. And so that's one of the questions that we're hoping to have courts answer in this case. But certainly it should be that if you can point to the specific actions of this municipality in its own jurisdiction, that should be sufficient, because the point is simply to highlight whether this is a good faith application of the criminal law or whether this is the use of the power of the police to silence someone who's using their First Amendment rights to speak out against the government.
So let's move on to qualified immunity. That's something that we thought potentially could come up in this case. How did it come up? How did we get to, you know, from the First Amendment to fighting about this whole other thing?
Yeah, so qualified immunity is a defense, which means that it only comes up in a lawsuit once you've filed the lawsuit and the governmental actors on the other side respond. And so in this case, as Anya mentioned earlier, that's exactly what they did. The individual government officials who are defendants in this lawsuit, they asserted qualified immunity. In fact, I think the way they phrased it in their motion to dismiss the case was that the individual defendants enjoy qualified immunity, which I think is an insightful way to think about how this doctrine works, because it is something that is enjoyed by government officials in that it completely allows them to escape any sort of accountability and avoid a court ever addressing the substance of the claims against them. And so here, that would be the court addressing whether what they did was intended to retaliate against Sylvia's use of her First Amendment rights. And so they claim qualified immunity on the one hand to defend the individual officers. And then another special protection that Anya also mentioned earlier, it comes through a Supreme Court case called Monell, which says that you can only sue a municipality for its official custom or policy. And so they're saying, well, even if what the individuals did here was a constitutional violation, they're entitled to qualified immunity, and you can't sue the city because this wasn't an official city policy. And we point out that when you're dealing with people like the mayor and the city manager and a member of city council and the police chief, that becomes city policy because those are city policy makers, and they're wielding the power of the city when they retaliate against someone like Sylvia for speaking.
So Anya, when you described the claims, you said that there was the one against the individual officers and the officials, and then the one against the city. And is that's how they responded then? They said, well, you can't come after the officials because qualified immunity, and you can't go after the city because Monell.
That's exactly.
And then what? So if the court says, yeah, they're right, is that it? Can they say, okay, you can't go after them, but we can talk about, you know, the First Amendment. I mean, what does that mean for Sylvia?
Yeah, if basically they say that qualified immunity applies and municipal liability protections apply, then the suit gets dismissed at the trial court, right? We would, of course, appeal to the Fifth Circuit and say that the district court was wrong. But fundamentally, right, at the trial level that would stop the lawsuit in its tracks. And as we mentioned earlier, our complaint provides a lot of facts in there, and the burden generally on people who file complaint should not be that high, right? But we already coming in with evidence saying that, listen, this is pretty clearly a retaliatory motive, right? So that would not matter, because qualified immunity stops everything without getting into the investigation of facts, right? Just because they get to work for the government, they, as Patrick used that word, and as they did in motion to dismiss, they enjoy qualified immunity. So they don't even have to defend themselves. So in the motion to dismiss, the lawyers didn't really try to say that we were wrong in alleging what we were alleging. No, they just said the individual officers and officials enjoy qualified immunity, and the city itself enjoys protections provided by this case called Monell. So don't worry about it. Go away. And that's really kind of fundamentally what's so very wrong about qualified immunity, that it shuts the courthouse doors to people with valid constitutional claims without even going into trying to understand and look at the evidence and figure out whether what they're alleging in fact happened.
It's interesting, because I think that to the extent that people think of qualified immunity as something that's defensible, you think, well, you know, it will protect these people from frivolous lawsuits. But the interesting thing is it also seems to prevent the development of the law. I mean, if what we wanted to do is kind of tease out this this exemption, you know, that Patrick described in First Amendment cases that deal with retaliation, that could, it seems like it, how would that ever happen if people are claiming qualified immunity? Is that right? Is there a way to ever develop the law on these issues if the government is always just saying, no, we're not going to go there?
No, well, and that's, yeah, go ahead. That's one of the huge problems with these overlapping doctrines. Like you said, we're dealing with more than one doctrine. Qualified immunity is a huge one of them. But essentially, anytime you bring a civil rights lawsuit against the government and its actors, you get some response that's like, first, my dog didn't bite that person. And second, I don't have a dog. And as you point out, Melanie, the problem here is that without a case like this, you have no effective constitutional rights. So if the city of Castle Hills and the individual defendants both prevail on this motion, and Sylvia's case is never allowed to go forward, that just means that someone is allowed to violate her First Amendment rights and in turn violate anyone else's First Amendment rights, and they can't do anything about it, which, you know, in my opinion, takes away the concept of that being a right. What the purpose of the Bill of Rights is to restrict the actions that government officials can take. And if you can't enforce the Bill of Rights against those government officials, what good are those rights to you or me?
Just to add like one thing for law nerds out there, right? Technically, when the district court is going to look at whether qualified immunity applies, they could, if they wanted to, say it is a constitutional violation, but it's not clearly established, so it goes away. So if a court were to do that, then at least we would get a ruling that would say, yes, her constitutional rights were violated, but the officials were not fairly notified that that this would happen, so the suit goes away. But what generally happens now after a 2009 Supreme Court case is that courts don't really have to make any kind of declarations or holdings on whether what happened was a violation of constitutional right. They just can skip answering that question altogether. And then, as you point out, Melanie, in that case, there would be no specific declaration, and then they could do exactly what they did to Sylvia to somebody else and continue with that.
So it seems that the best case scenario is that the court says, no, that, you know, you're not protected, what you did and what you did violated her rights. And then the worst case scenario is where they say qualified immunity doesn't apply, or qualified immunity applies, and we're not going to go there. There's this sort of middle case where Sylvia's out of luck, but subsequent people in her position, almost in her exact position, right, would be able to potentially prevail.
Yeah, that's a very good way to kind of describe the three ways a qualified immunity decision could go. The unfortunate thing is that the worst, the very worst scenario you outlined is the one that we see happen more often than not, right? Where the courts don't really make a determination on the constitutionality of a particular action, and they just throw the case away for that reason. And then you don't even have a precedential value. You just have, all right, they were government workers, qualified immunity applied to them, and they keep continue doing what they've been doing. That's kind of, yeah.
Yeah, and for corollary reasons, that's particularly dangerous to constitutional rights, because when courts decide that, for example, the Ninth Circuit had a decision last year where it said that officers who were alleged to have stolen $200,000 while executing a search warrant were entitled to qualified immunity. In that case, the Ninth Circuit specifically said, this isn't clearly established, but we're not going to address whether that was a constitutional violation. And so the corollary of what that situation presents is that now police in all the states in the Ninth Circuit, including California, Alaska, Hawaii, and many others, now police in those states have noticed that they can steal money while executing a search warrant, and it's not clearly established that that's a constitutional violation for which they could face some sort of accountability under a civil rights lawsuit.
So not only are the citizens not getting additional protection, there's just increasing swaths of bad behavior that is being sanctioned, basically.
Yeah, exactly. They're saying this is an area where you can't hold government workers accountable if they do this to you.
So given that, I mean, we've talked about cases coming from the Supreme Court, the Ninth Circuit, given that there is so much happening now, you know, in those higher courts, and as we discussed, the very real potential that the court at the district level just says, nope, qualified immunity applies, this goes away. What are the prospects for a case like Sylvia, especially coming from IJ as a public interest law firm, where what we want to do is create precedent? What are we hoping could come out of this?
There are just so many great potential rulings that an engaged judge could make, right? And without really even going all the way. To begin with, when it comes to qualified immunity, it would be nice if a judge were to say, everybody knows, including government workers, that you're not supposed to retaliate against someone for their speech, right? There is case law in the Fifth Circuit, there is case law in the U.S. Supreme Court, there is case law everywhere that specifically says that you can't retaliate and punish. You can't punish somebody for, speaking out against the government. If the court were to say that that's enough for officers to actually have fair warning, that they're not supposed to retaliate, then that would be huge, right? Because one of the big problems with the qualified immunity doctrine is that it is being interpreted so very narrowly on facts that a court could very well say, oh, there was another woman whose name was not Sylvia to whom this happened. But listen, this woman's name is Sylvia, so therefore qualified immunity applies, right? So if the court were to actually look more at a broader principle of clearly established law rather than narrower, that would be a huge step forward. The other things that could happen that would be great if the Supreme Court basically has this case, Nieves, where it says that you can't sue for First Amendment violation if there is probable cause to arrest you, right? But it provides, as Patrick mentioned, some exceptions. And it would be great if this case, a court were to look at and say, you know what, this is exactly what the Supreme Court meant, right? There are certain exceptions where, like jaywalking exception, where they obviously are using this law as a pretext to arrest. So in this case, we're not even going to care whether there is probable cause or not, because quite frankly, probable cause doesn't tell us much, because this statute really is not being used against people like Sylvia. So that's pretty obviously a violation. So that would be really great to have a court basically talk about that, as well as, you know, municipal liability front, right? What does it mean to actually have an official policy or custom? So we could make important headways in this case on this many different levels of procedural threshold doctrines, as well as the First Amendment law itself.
Yeah, and those are definitely the targeted areas that we're interested in this case, and we expect to try to make some headway on. But obviously, as you suggested, Melanie, we leave on the table the possibility that this is a case that could hopefully get back to the Supreme Court, where it would revisit qualified immunity and whether that doctrine has any basis in American law, which it doesn't, except for in this decision from the 1980s. It's one of those plan for the worst, hope for the best. We would love for this case to be that case, but we brought it with a more specific focus on those targeted issues that Anya mentioned.
Well, thank you both for taking the time to talk through it, because it is a complicated one. But with that, we are out of time for today. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can find more on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to subscribe.